This week on Life and Faith.
A person so addicted to pornography has reached a point where they can't actually have sexual relations with a person, an actual living person.
Yeah.
Such that they actually need to rely on the infrastructure of pornography in order to facilitate the actual sexual act. And the reason why I found this fascinating is that when I found that metaphysical reversal, or realized that there was a metaphysical reversal present in pornography, it made me realize that pornography was not really about the sex.
We're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
And Justine, I'm a little bit concerned about what lies in store for us today with that
really?
Grab.
Why?
The metaphysics of porn. It sounds like that conversation could go in all sorts of directions, all of them worrying.
I do get that. And while I'm not trying to one-up you, I'm also concerned. I admit that this Life and Faith is a little bit different to what we normally make. And I think it could go either way. It could confirm people's worst prejudices about theology as being abstract and totally disconnected from the real world. Or, on the plus side, it could show people that theology has something really distinctive to offer and can shed a really valuable light on the sorts of lives that we live today. So,
Let's assume it's going to be the latter. Do we need a parental warning?
Well, not exactly. I wouldn't say there's anything explicit, and when porn is being talked about, it's being used as a critique, okay? Now, I just want to say, how about you sit back, let the interview wash over you, I'll check in with you halfway and see what you think.
Okay.
We don't get into the porn critique immediately. First, we meet Matthew John Paul Tan, who blogs at Awkward Asian Theologian. I first asked him, what's with the name of the blog?
The name started out as a hashtag that I use on my social media posts. It was originally sort of used to depict certain experiences that I had in my day-to-day life that were either, you know, awkward, that hearkened to my ethnic identity or to my role as a theologian. So when I started blogging, I became more aware of this gap between academic theology on the one hand and personal experience on the other. I came to the study of theology with this commitment that theology is not just a series of abstract ideas, but actually has something to say about everyday life. And so when I progressed in my blogging career, such as it is, I came to realize that there was a need for a blog that will cater for the high-level academic theology as well as personal experience and make academic theology speak to that experience. That became the sort of genesis for the blog Awkward Asian Theologian.
So what was your path to becoming a theologian? Because I'm suspecting you're a bit of an outlier in your field. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're young, you're Singaporean. What gives? You know, tell me.
Yeah.
You would frustrate most people's understanding of a theologian, I suppose, if they ever thought, what is a theologian?
I had no intention whatsoever of becoming a theologian. When you grow up in an Asian family, the last thing that an Asian parent has for their hopes for their son's professional development is to become a theologian. You know, theologians were people that we kind of made fun of, and it was something that ran completely against what was, you know, within the plan, you know, being an Asian.
No theologian.
Absolutely. Asian success.
No theology here.
Asian success involves doctors, lawyers, engineers, that kind of thing, bankers and so on. And so actually my educational training was preparing me for a career in the law. It's just that I also supplemented it with studies in the humanities. It started out in politics, That was where my delving into the humanities began. That went into history. It went into later on in diplomatic history. And when I went into my honors year, I did a thesis on microstate diplomacy. And it just so happened that the microstate that I was looking at was the Vatican.
Yeah, right.
and it was the Vatican in its diplomatic relations with, of all things, Nazi Germany. And that really was what led me down the path of doctoral studies in international relations. I had an intention to study the role that theology plays in the political actions of Catholic actors. But it just so happened that the only place that I could actually finish this thesis was in a theology department. And that's how I ended up shifting my doctoral studies to a theology department. And that's how I became a theologian.
Now, you've recently authored some papers on the metaphysics of porn.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Indeed. Before we get to the porn part, yes. What's the metaphysics part? What is metaphysics?
Sure. Metaphysics is a study of philosophy that tries to get to the ultimate reality of things. It tries to pare back everyday reality to basically say, where does this reality actually sit on or stand on, right? What is the ground of the real that from which we actually come to experience everyday reality?
Yeah, so it's kind of like the idea that what sits behind everything else, what can we really be sure of,
exactly.
I suppose?
If you were to pull the curtain back on the things that you see, hear, and touch, what is actually going on behind that? That is the study of philosophy in general, but it's certainly the prime concern of metaphysics.
Okay, so it sounds very abstract. It sounds like mm-hmm. there's a lot of theorizing going on.
Mm-hmm.
How then does porn fit into this? Because porn seems like, I suppose, a collision of bodies, right? A collision of flesh.
Mm.
What has metaphysics got to do with porn?
Sure. I was trying to look behind bodies that are involved in the depictions of pornography and actually say, is there something going on that accounts for the cultural pull that pornography has in our society? At first, I was thinking, is it the sex? And as I did more study into it, it sort of occurred to me, it was working off a hunch that it actually was not about the sex. It was actually something else behind it. But when I asked that question, I came to the realization that what I was asking was not a sociological question, which is what pornography is, a sociological phenomenon. It actually was a question of metaphysics, where reality lies.
Let me interrupt you there.
Sure.
So you argue then that there's a kind of metaphysical backstory to
Correct.
Pornography, and one that brings in the thoughts of some Christian medieval thinkers,
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so walk us through that, and you'll have mm-hmm. to walk us through because I do not know what you're talking about.
Absolutely. That's fine. When I started looking into the metaphysics of pornography, one of the things that stuck to my mind was a particular theme of metaphysics that you see in medieval philosophers and theologians like Thomas Aquinas. Now, Aquinas basically had this idea in metaphysics that when you look at reality, there are these two things that you need to sort of have at the back of your mind. The first is what is known as act or actuality, which is what things actually are like. And you have, on the other hand, potency or potentiality or possibility. When you look at anything in this world, you are looking at these two things at once. So to give you an idea, mind you, this is an example that is used by philosophers as ancient as Aristotle. When I look at an acorn, I am looking at an actual acorn. The actuality is in its acornness.
Mm-hmm.
However, I know that an acorn is not just an acorn. It can become something else. An acorn is a potential oak tree. And so when I behold an acorn, I behold the actual acorn and I behold the potential oak tree.
The possibilities inherent in that acorn.
Exactly. Yeah. The possibilities inherent in that acorn, and those possibilities are present or actualized in the actuality of its acornness. When Aquinas talked about the things that we behold and the metaphysics of the things that we behold, he also followed a medieval dictum that prioritized actuality over possibility. In other words, where reality lies is in its actuality. An acorn can be a potential oak tree, but it's only a real potential oak tree when it is still an acorn. In other words, so the ground of reality is in its actuality as an acorn. You affirm the fact
you
that it's an acorn.
You want to honor that it's an acorn.
Correct. You honor the fact that it's an acorn.
Okay.
And you honor its actuality as an acorn, and then as a sapling, and then as a young tree, and then finally as the oak tree.
Okay, so then map this on to sex and pornography.
Okay.
What's going on there?
Before we get to the sex and pornography, there was another thing that we need to talk about with respect to the metaphysics. Because in order for you to understand the metaphysics of pornography, you need to understand that what I just said, the priority that I just mentioned about actuality over potency, gets reversed.
So now possibility becomes more ideal, more
not only more desirous, but also more real.
Right, okay.
Right. We see this in from the Middle Ages onwards, which becomes the ground of the way we actually think about reality and the world for the next 800 years. So with this reversal, we see the priority of the potential over actuality. And when this happens, we see potentiality as... or possibility as somehow more appealing. And because it's more appealing, it is therefore more real and more attractive and a better ground for our existence than actual reality. When you reverse the relationship of actuality over potency, such that potency becomes more important or prioritized over the actual, it is not just that what is possible is more attractive, but also what is virtual becomes more real than what is actually out there in reality. So you then start to have the groundwork, the philosophical or metaphysical groundwork for a virtual world being habitable, right? You can conceive of a virtual world. And not only that, you can actually conceive of the virtual world as something that is as real, if not even more real, than reality itself.
So now, 800 years later, teen boys, a theoretical teen boy, who is so invested and engaged with pornography that a real woman fails to excite him.
Exactly. And you see this in the sociological study, where a person so addicted to pornography has reached a point where they can't actually... have sexual relations with a person, an actual living person. Such that they actually need to rely on the infrastructure of pornography in order to facilitate the actual sexual act. And the reason why I found this fascinating is that when I found that metaphysical reversal, or realized that there was a metaphysical reversal present in pornography, it made me realize that pornography was not really about the sex.
This would be surprising to plenty of people out there for you to say this. So why is it not about the sex?
There is a fascinating sociologist of pornography named Gail Dines,
who wrote the
book Pornland. And one of the things that comes out in Pornland is not just about the porn itself, but that part of the cultural power of pornography lies in the various types, subtypes of pornography possible. The multiplication of the types of sex depicted in pornographic films suggests to me that the consumer of porn is not really interested in the sex per se, but actually interested in the types of sex that can be consumed.
So meaning that whatever your particular sexual interest or peccadillo, you can find it represented somewhere out on there on the internet.
Correct.
It's kind of any variation you
any variation that you can possibly think of is put on display.
Yeah.
And it's that possibility that actually forms the pull, right, of pornography for the consumer.
Yeah. So your interest in pornography is that it's kind of, it's pressing on our buttons,
mm-hmm.
particularly when it comes to our desire for more, right? Mm. This kind of possibility that you're talking about.
Correct.
And it's also, you've also mentioned that the virtual assumes a priority over what's actually in front of you. So if I can be devil's advocate for a minute, what's the harm here? Because if it's for the desire for more, surely that's a natural desire that all of us have. And if it's for the unreal, then if no one's getting harmed, right, if there's no realness here, we all mm-hmm. know that it's a fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
What's the problem?
Okay. The harm that we see lies in the effect that the priority of the virtual has over the actual and what effect that has on our attitudes to the actual. When we live in a world that prioritizes what is possible over what is actual, the actual starts to become incredibly boring, unattractive, and we are given an imperative that the actual is something that we need to leave behind. Not just leave behind, but in circumstances where you can't leave it behind, there is an imperative for you to actually get rid of what is actual. And one of the things that it also affects is the propensity of the person to actually commit to one particular body. If pornography is about the consumption of various varieties of bodies, then its effect on the ability of the person to commit to one particular body, it becomes diminished because all of a sudden, that one particular actual body is seen as a limit to the possibilities that can be obtained online.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Justine is talking to Matt Tan of Awkward Asian Theologian.
So what do you reckon, Simon? Are you still with us? How do you understand the argument as it's unfolding?
Oh, for sure. It's interesting. The possible over the actual, what he's talking about there. And that brings up all sorts of questions I'm sure we'll get to later. But I guess this is really, well, it seems to me that this, yeah, it's history and it's theology, but he's bringing in some very real life application.
Yeah, well, he's talking about how medieval theologians were committed to this order where what is actually there takes priority over what might be, but that sometime in the 12th century, this order becomes reversed.
It so flips.
So we're suddenly more convinced that reality lies in the realm of the virtual, in the realm of what might be, rather than what is. So he talks about this acorn example. The medieval theologians wanted to honour the acorn as an acorn and not, let's say, judge it or shame it for what it wasn't, which was, you know, an oak tree. They wanted to honour it.
And the shift brings about probably not terrible things, but it does open up a foundation for what we now have, whereas a focus on the possible, the virtual, over the physical and the actual.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It lays a foundation, and then we can see the outworkings of that through the way that we consume porn. And I mean we in the general sense.
and only took 800 years.
Well, sure, but there's a lot of stuff that also this can apply to.
Yeah, and Justin, I think this sounds like it might apply more broadly. I mean, we are a culture that has more and more of everything, and yet in some ways seem deeply dissatisfied.
Yeah, well, Matt says this emphasis on what might be versus what is actually there becomes this repeated pattern throughout our culture. Here's how one Bobby Mook put it in a TED Talk on FOMO, right? The fear of missing out. You'll hear him pick up the story, but let me just set it up. He asks us to imagine, you know, it's the end of a long week, you're lying in bed with a book and you're settling in, but then your friend texts you a video.
We've all had that experience.
And as soon as you press that regrettable finger to the play button, your phone erupts with music. And as the beat drops and the camera pans over the crowd, you see all of your best friends at a packed house party having the time of their lives. And a massive wave of FOMO hits you. Whereas just a couple moments before, you were blissfully happy in your bed. Now, You feel so inadequate sitting in your bed at 10 p.m. on a Friday night in your PJs.
Back to Matt. Here he is offering examples explaining just how far that porn logic extends.
The other phenomenon that I also see is in this phenomenon of lifestyle photography, where you start seeing depictions of various lifestyles, whether it's on whether it's a holiday, whether it is vanning, whether it is the production of food.
Food porn?
Food porn.
Yeah, right.
You've got various lifestyles depicted on platforms like Instagram, for instance, and they all play by the same logic. There's this sort of idea that what is depicted in the platform is actually seen as the standard of desirability to which your actual efforts, whether it is your efforts in producing a curry or your actual holiday, your actual holiday in the Southern Highlands, comes up short.
Yeah, you're always haunted by the life you could be living.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
You always are haunted by the worry that your holiday is not Insta-worthy.
Yeah. You're missing out. Yeah. So there's this New York Times article, which talks about Instagram, and in that there's a woman who's being interviewed, and she talks about her friend, the filmmaker Heather Fink. Mm-hmm. whose filmmaking takes her to all these exotic destinations around the globe. And so this woman says of her, she's in Cannes, she's in New Mexico, she's in Abu Dhabi for a film shoot, she's going to Holland. She was just at Jared Harris's wedding. I don't know who Jared Harris is, but it was on a yacht in Miami, so clearly it's very impressive. And so she's flicking through this woman's Instagram posts while standing in the pharmacy in her stained sweatpants. I love that detail. And she's like, I really need to up my game in life. So what do you make of that, Matt? I mean, it feels like everyone has a friend like Fink, right? Like,
yes.
Who is living the better life than you're living.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And this kind of maps on entirely to what you're talking about.
It maps on to the warp and weft of everyday life. And it can be something as mundane as flicking through Instagram as you're waiting in line and in the pharmacy.
Yeah.
So this is not something that is limited to big cultural phenomena. It's actually in the texture of everyday life.
Yeah. And I'm thinking also about online dating where, mm-hmm. gosh, you could just swipe left indefinitely, right?
Yes.
And then you can imagine that if you decide to go on a date with someone, are you haunted by the possibility that there might be someone better out there who you could be more happier with?
Absolutely. The way this is institutionalized is actually in the imperative to ensure that the person that you are dating fits a particular list that you yourself have generated.
Oh, man. And we all have the list, don't
we? And
we
always come up. And doesn't the person always come up short of the list? And that list is institutionalized potentiality over actuality.
Yeah, right. So are you saying that a better way to approach the list is to kind of try and reverse it and saying, what are the actualities that are the things that actually matter?
Absolutely. And not just what actually matters. Look at the person that is in front of you,
yeah,
and
right.
actually
start
see
from there
what that person is like and say, can I commit to this person? Otherwise, the primary commitment is not to the person, but to the list. And there's something quite horrifying at the idea that your priority of what you want in a spouse is actually to be found in the list and not in an actual person.
Yes, and how depressing to think that maybe you do commit to someone, but mm-hmm. you're always judging them against the list.
Absolutely.
And the other person's like, oh my gosh, I never measure up.
Absolutely.
Yeah, wow. Right. And we're doing this in everyone's direction.
And you do this
People do it for kids as well, right?
Absolutely. Do your kids actually match up the kids that you wish that they could become? But it's all forms of human relations that get affected by this metaphysics of potency over act, which is why it is such a subtle change, but at the same time, such a radical one as well.
Yeah, and that sounds absolutely corrosive of, mm-hmm. of human relationships.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so we're addicted, it sounds like, to endless possibility,
mm-hmm.
right? And plugged into a system that kind of feeds our addiction through various ways all the mm-hmm. time. So are you pretty glum about our chances of resisting any of this?
Am I glum? At one level, I am, simply because the infrastructure that we have is so entrenched. The person who wants to resist it has to very consciously come up with a practice that slowly orients or reorients their desire for endless possibility to a commitment and attention to what is actually in front of them. The philosopher Simone Weil once said that attention is the greatest form of charity. And I think we need to sort of take that up as a clarion call to underpin the resistance of a metaphysics of possibility.
So would you say that you are, I mean, you would be yourself engaged in a faith community,
mm-hmm.
and you have a very big mind, and you know, you're drawing on all the wisdom of the ages, particularly of Christian thinkers in this area.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going? Let's talk about you. How are you going with this? Have you found a way out of the maze?
My answer would be I'm going as well as everybody else, and that is not well. However, Christians or people in from faith communities have a particular resource in that they are making a commitment to a particular community. And that commitment to a community, to the actuality of the members of that community with all of their complexities, with all of their imperfections, in a way acts as a sort of counter-discipline to reorient our desire for the potential and actually face up to the actuality of the person that is in front of you in that community.
Yes, and it's not a fantasized, oh, I'll love my, you know, the person can be from across the world from me, but I will totally love them and I can look past all our differences. No, it's actually your neighbor is right next to you and you need to be faced with their reality, and they're going to annoy you and drive you mad, but mm-hmm. your job is to love them.
Absolutely. And not just to love them in one big act of love, but to commit, you know, in small acts of love day by day for the rest of your life. That is, in a way, an even bigger ask than actually asking them to do this one great act of love.
Let's go back to the porn question.
Mm.
And if theology is kind of correctly diagnosing the sort of metaphysics that are going that is going on in mm-hmm. the phenomenon of pornography, does it provide solutions in that direction?
Christian communities, religious communities in general, but certainly Christian communities, are enjoined or have the imperative to commit to the complexities of everyday life in the context of the communities that they find themselves in that have been brought together by Jesus Christ. As a result, the solution to pornography is not simply a question of not looking at pornography. The solution to pornography is sort of reversing or challenging its metaphysical commitment of possibility over actuality. And Christian community provides that solution insofar as it commits itself to the actuality of the members of the Christian community that are formed around Jesus Christ.
So real bodies, real lives is the solution.
Real bodies, real lives, real communities in real space and time.
Well, thanks today to Matt Tan, who blogs at Awkward Asian Theologian. You might also want to check out his book, Redeeming Flesh, The Way of the Cross with Zombie Jesus. You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity, and maybe you need to lie down after this expansive episode.
Well, I would say don't go and lie down, because unless you're actually tired, you're probably going to find yourself scrolling through Instagram, Facebook, or real estate listings if you're like me, because that's my kind of porn, so to speak, and basically feeding that chronic dissatisfaction. I would say commit to your actual life, not what might be.
Get out in the real world with real people.
That's right.
So, Justine, should I not then offer a preview of next week? Because at this point in time, that episode is still only a possibility. It's not an actuality.
No, you can, because next week's episode is almost an actuality.
Okay, then. Next week on Life and Faith.
I love those. I think those are the funnest cases to work, because they seem so impossible to begin with. And it's probably going to be something that's hidden in plain sight that's going to solve it. And so it's kind of like you're puzzling. So you get to, you know, look at the crime scenes, and there's stuff in the crime scene, and you're looking at it and you're thinking, okay, everyone's been looking at the same set of evidence, but they're missing something. What am I going to do to change the way I see this, or to, so I can somehow reimagine it, so I can catch the thing that everyone's been missing for 30 years.